Hi everyone, welcome back. I see Rabbi Kalman is not here today, but I'm glad to see so many people are. Let me share my sources and we will get started. So first of all, of course, we want to dedicate our learning to the return, the immediate return of our hostages and the safety of our soldiers and the refuah shlema of anybody who has been hurt or has been wounded, and to the end of this war. That's a lot. Learn good. Okay, so we are on class number three. Things have been stretching out a little more than I thought they were going to, which is fine. So today, last time we kind of finished up talking about places in Eretz Yisrael, and kind of leading out of Eretz Yisrael, the Eber HaYarden, the Transjordan, Sulam HaShel Tzor, right, the ladder of Tyre. Okay, someone else just put the sources in, but thank you. Today we're actually really going to leave, right? We're really going to go abroad from Eretz Yisrael. We're going to spend a lot of time in Babylonia, okay? Just to understand where we're talking about. Babylonia, not so much on this map. We're going to get to maps of Babylonia, but obviously out over there across the Fertile Crescent. But we are also going to talk about places around the Mediterranean. Okay. Rome, of course, is going to be important. Alexandria in Egypt. We're going to talk about Tadmor and Palmyra in Syria. We're going to talk about Asia Minor in Turkey, Turkey of today. Okay, so we're really going to be traveling around to a lot of different places today. So we'll take them one by one, but just to understand the larger picture of what we're doing. We're going to get started by talking about travelers who went back and forth to Babylonia. Okay, besides the land of Israel, the other most important place when we talk about the Gemara, certainly the Mishnah, not yet. We have only a little bit of scholarship in Babylonia in the time of the Mishnah. Mostly it's in Eretz Yisrael. Why, with the Tanaim, we only have rabbis from the land of Israel. By the time we get to the Amoraim, we have in both places. And by the time we get to the end of the period of the Amoraim, the supremacy is really with the Babylonian rabbis, but we'll get there. Okay. But when we're talking about the time of the Amoraim, you have a lot of traveling back and forth. And when you learn Gemara, this is coming up all the time, right? Amrei b'Maariva. This is what they say in the West, of course, being the land of Israel, if you're in Babylonia. Or it talks about this one who is Yored leBavel. He goes down to Babylonia. Or Ala leEretz Yisrael. He goes up to the land of Israel. Right? Lots of traveling back and forth. How do you usually travel, right? Although the simplest way would seem to be going from the Galilee directly straight to Babylonia. Oh, sorry. Pressed the wrong thing there. Nobody does that. You don't travel that way because that's traveling across the desert. That's not a good way to travel. So instead, you do what people have done for millennia, which is travel through the Fertile Crescent, right? Going up and down to the land between the rivers, Mesopotamia. Okay, sometimes, like we saw last time, you might go up towards the ladder of Tyre, Sulam HaShel Tzor, right? And then cut across. Okay, but usually you would go out the eastern side of the land of Israel, go up through what today we would call northern Syria, and then across to the land between the rivers, okay, between the Prat and the Hiddekel, the Tigris and the Euphrates. The walk takes about 2 weeks, right? We know this, first of all, because you could measure it, but also because we talk about our prayers for rain, right? The rabbis talk about how we don't start praying for rain after Sukkot until it's 2 weeks afterwards, because we want to allow time for all the travelers to get back from Eretz Yisrael, from Jerusalem to Babylonia. And that's the furthest trip you would take would be to go to Babylonia. Okay, so you have travelers who are going back and forth. In the time of the Mishnah, and particularly in the time of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, the great Beit Midrash of Rabbi Judah the Prince in Beit Sha'arim, and later in Tzipori, you have rabbis who are coming from Babylonia to learn in the land of Israel. They want to bring back the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. So very famously, we have Rabbi Chiya, and Rabbi Chiya brings with him his nephew, Rav, okay? And they come to learn in Eretz Yisrael. Okay? Now, there are times in Eretz Yisrael where things are very bad. For example, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, we talked a little about this last time, with Usha and the rebuilding, right? And who's left. And at that point, right, there are rabbis who go to Babylonia, among them, Hanina, the brother of Rabbi Yoshua, and he starts to do things that usually are only done in the land of Israel. He starts to do Ibur Shana, right, to add the extra month to make a leap year. And the rabbis in the land of Israel sent him a message saying, well, what do you think you're doing? You're not allowed to do that. And he says, well, there was nobody in the land of Israel. There's no great authorities anymore in the land of Israel. And the rabbis in the land of Israel write him and they say, you left behind these little baby goats and they've become full mature goats, meaning leadership has grown up in the land of Israel. Don't think that Babylonia is going to take the place of the land of Israel. Eretz Israel always has to have primacy. And that's a debate that's going to continue into the Middle Ages. It's a very important debate. But by the time we get to the Amoraim, okay, by the time we get to the later 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century, a lot of troubles in the land of Israel. The yeshivot in Babylonia are becoming stronger and stronger. And so you need to A, weigh in with the rabbis in Babylonia, and B, the rabbis in Babylonia want to know what's happening in the land of Israel. Things are not so great there. They want to know. They want to get that Torah. They want to hold on to it. So we have a whole group of people who are known as the Nechute, right? Aramaic for going down. Remember we said when you go to Babylonia, you're going down. In the second, the third, and the fourth generation of Amoraim, we have these people who travel back and forth regularly. Okay, they might have come from Eretz Israel, but they're going to Babylonia, they're going back and forth all the time, and they are bringing Torah back and forth. Probably the most famous one is Ula. And if you look at the sources here, okay, the first source in the Gemara and Brachot, and our colleagues who descended from Eretz Yisrael, who is the sage with this title? Ula, right? Ula said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. They're bringing a lot of the Torah of Rabbi Yochanan. And we hear about a lot about Ula traveling back and forth. He's in the second, third generation of the Amoraim, brings the Torah of Rabbi Yochanan, goes to Babylonia, stays with Rav Nachman, very important Babylonian Amora. Okay. Later, the next generation, we have someone named Rav Dimi, also always going back and forth, Rabin, a generation later. Okay. And what are they doing? They're bringing this Torah. And they have to bring information like, for example, right? Look at the second source here. When Ula came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, he said they sanctified the new moon in the west. Now, obviously, he's not talking about the Kiddush HaChodesh that happened like yesterday, right? Because he wouldn't have gotten there in time. But he wants them to know when was the Kiddush HaChodesh last month so that they can determine the holidays that are coming up. Okay, the calendar, very, very important that Eretz Yisrael holds on to the job of creating the calendar. Okay, now you can imagine this traveling back and forth, you wouldn't always. The state you might have broken telephone. Maybe what you're saying isn't accurate. It's where we have this great quote here from the Gemara and Shabbos, the third source here. Rav Dimi ascended to Nahardah. He sent to the yeshiva students, the statements I said to you, they are my mistake. However, this is what they said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, right? Rav Dimi, no false pride. He has no problem in saying what I told you wasn't really what Rabbi Yochanan said. I made a mistake. This is the accurate thing. And even today, with our traveling news traveling at the speed of light, things are often made, mistakes are made. But not everybody is as humble as Rav Dimi to say, no, I made a mistake. Now here we have a great one. This next source in the Gemara and Shabbos 108. Sometimes the rabbis in Babylonia, they just didn't get it. They were like, what are you talking about? That can't be correct. Right? Rabbeinu came from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, and he said, no person has ever drowned in the Sea of Sodom. What's the Sea of Sodom? Yam HaMelech. Right? I just went with tourists this week to Yam HaMelech, to the Dead Sea, and I told the kids, you're going to float. Don't worry. There's no way that you can't float. You have to float because the water's going to hold you up. Anyone who's been to the land of Israel or knows a little about the land of Israel knows this about the Dead Sea. But in Babylonia, they say, what are you talking about? Rav Yosef said, stone is overturned. Rav Dini's statement is backwards. It is a man who does not drown in the Dead Sea, but a plank sinks. How could this be? This can't be true, right? But Rav Dini knows what he's talking about. He's seen the Dead Sea. Rav Yosef has not, okay? And we hear about this traveling back and forth again. The Gemara in Bava Kamma, Rav Yosef, some say it was Rabbah, would announce those that ascend, right? The Olim, the ones who come to the land of Israel from Babylonia, as well as those that descend, the ones that come from, or the other way around, right? They come from, ascending is going from Babel up to Eretz Yisrael, descending is going from Eretz Yisrael to Babel. They all agree. So we have this traffic back and forth. And in fact, we even have, it seems, testimony that the yeshivot in the land of Israel and in Babylonia would try to study the same tractates at the same time, right? They would try to have a conversation going. And it was a very, very fertile one. However, by the 4th century, things get bad in the land of Israel. More persecution. Roman Empire becomes Christians. There's religious persecution, economic troubles, and this phenomenon kind of comes to an end. But it's a very important one for a good 3 centuries. This phenomenon of the nechute, of the traveling back and forth. Okay, now that we've traveled back and forth, let's actually see what's going on in Babel itself. So first of all, important to understand, Babylonian Jewish community is a very, very old Jewish community. In fact, about, I don't know, 10 years ago, the last Babylonian Jew, or really, right, Iraqi Jew, made Aliyah, meaning it's the longest galut ever. Starts already in 597 BCE, even before the destruction of the first temple, where we have the Galut HaRashma Mazger, Galut Yehoyachin, obviously continues in 586 when the temple is destroyed, and it keeps on going. Now it has high points and low points. Throughout the time of the Second Temple period, you have a thriving community in Babylonia, but you don't have a lot of scholarship. We don't hear about a lot of scholarship. That only happens later. Okay. Now, just to understand, because we're going to be talking about this in another minute, who controls, who rules over the area of Babylonia? Okay. And we're not just talking about Iraq. We're also talking about Iran and even further. We'll see a map in a few minutes. From 247 BCE until 211 CE, right? So give or take 400, 350 years, 450 years, sorry. The Parthians, right? You have a Parthian Empire, influenced by the Persians, influenced by Hellenists, by Greeks. They're a very powerful empire. They are on the, Eretz Israel is on the frontier of the Roman Empire, right? We're still the Roman Empire, but we're on the edge of the Parthian Empire, and that's why we're so important, to the Romans throughout the Roman-Parthian wars, okay, that are happening in the 1st century before the Common Era. Meanwhile, just to put us a little context, right, the second Beit HaMikdash is destroyed in the year 70, 200, the redaction of the Mishnah. And now let's get back to Bavel. Very important year, 219 of the Common Era. Rav, who had gone to the land of Israel to study with Rebbe, right, to study with his uncle Rabbi Chiya, who goes to study with Rebbe, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he returns to Babylonia. We get the beginnings of the two great yeshivot, Surah and Nehardah. We're going to talk about them in a minute, but Shmuel in Nehardah and Rav in Surah, right? Around the same time, the Parthian Empire is conquered by the Sasanians. Zoroastrianism becomes very important. It was important before, but now it becomes a state religion. That's going to have an effect on Jews. Okay. Meanwhile, a few decades later, Nehardah is destroyed. Rabbi Yehuda founds the yeshiva at Pumbedita. Rabbi Yosef Bar Chama founds the yeshiva at Machoza. Machoza is destroyed. The yeshiva moves again, partly to Pumbedita, partly to Naresh. And finally, towards the end of the 4th century, Rav Ashi moves the yeshiva of Sura to Mata Mechasya. Okay, so let's just understand where all those places are. And then, of course, the Muslim conquest in the early 7th century, which changes many, many things, but we're not going to get to that. We're not going that far. Okay, but let's understand where these places are. Okay, the first one is Nahardah. Nahardah is the first among equals. It's really, we're going to see it's the place where the Jews, the legend is this is where the Jews came ready with the destruction of the first temple. Okay, this is where Shmuel's father establishes the very first yeshiva in Babel. Rav comes along and he wants to break out and do his own thing. So he establishes the yeshiva in Sura. Okay, so we've got one and we've got two. I don't know, is this helpful to see these numbers? Okay, Nahardah is destroyed and we get the yeshiva of Pumbedita, founded by Rav Yehuda. Okay, so now we've got Pumbedita and Sura that are at the same time. Eventually, we have Mochoza, okay, number four, and Mata Mechasya, okay, number five. And we hear about all these places as well as other places in the Gemara. Right? The Gemara is always talking about these different places. They are not particularly far from each other. So if you wanted to travel from Pumbedita to Mochoza, it'll take you about a day's walk, about 12, 13 hours. If you wanted to travel from Pumbedita to Sura, it'll take you about 24 hours. Okay, these are not huge distances, and we know people travel back and forth. Certainly, if they're traveling back and forth from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, they could travel in this within Babylonia along the rivers, traveling back and forth. And as you can see, of course, all of these places are along the rivers. Everything in Babylonia that's important happens along the rivers. We even have places called Pumnahara, right, or Nahar Malka, places that are connected, or Nahardah, obviously, everything connected to the rivers. Okay, so that's just to give us a little bit of a sense. Hopefully, it's not super confusing. We are going to spend some time focusing on Nahardah and Sura, but obviously, we could talk about the others and the other Amoraim as well. But we're going to talk about those first ones, particularly Nahardah, which is really the very first, right? The one that is the father of all the others. Okay, just erasing, a little erasing, and moving right along. Okay, before we get to Nahardah, let's talk for a minute about the Sasanians and the Zoroastrians. Okay, so we said the Parthians are the guys who are the first rulers. They are at the same time as the Romans. The Sasanians come along early 3rd century, and they rule until the Muslim conquest, right? Until the early 7th century. So they are a long-lived, powerful empire. We'll see a picture. Picture coming up. Yeah, here's a picture of the Sasanian Empire at its height. Okay, in the 3rd century, it goes all the way from the border over here with the Roman Empire, meaning northern Syria, going all the way up to Armenia, going all the way down to Arabia. That's its western border. And it heads all the way out to India and Pakistan. It's a massive, massive empire. We are focusing on the part that's very much here in the west, right? This area that's Babylonia, but the Sasanians rule over a huge area. Their first king, this is the guy whose coin we have here, is Ardashir the First. And we have some conversations in the Gemara. Again, the Gemara is not a history book, but a lot of things come up by chance. Not by chance, just by the way. And we hear about the differences a little bit between the Parthians and the Sasanians. The Sasanians, perhaps because they have such a vast area to control, have a very centralized government. Which is not necessarily something that's good for the Jews. It seems the Jews had more autonomy under the Parthians than they did under the Sasanians, who are really in charge of controlling everything. It's and we also get hints of this when we hear about the Zoroastrians. Now, I will definitely recommend, Rabbi Kelman recommended it last time, and I listened to it, and it was great. Podcast with Dr. Shai Secunda, who is a huge expert on the Babylonian Talmud and on the on Zoroastrianism and the Sasanians. Very, very worth listening to. The podcast of Jewish Ideas, look up Shai Secunda, and he really goes much more into depth. We're just going to look at this for a minute. But the Zoroastrians, right? Zoroastrianism is a very ancient religion. It has had influence on Judaism. It's probably most importantly connected to, at least in the popular imagination, connected to fire, but also dualism, right? Good versus evil. Fighting it out, right? Who's going to win? God's on both sides. Obviously, I'm simplifying very much. The Gemara talks about Zoroastrian priests and uses two different terms. Okay. One is the Amgoshi, who are like magicians, actually more than two, but the two main ones. Okay. I didn't bring any sources about that, but Dr. Secunda talks about it. And the other is people called the Chabari. It's not 100% clear who they are, but based on the sources we're going to look at, it seems that these are Zoroastrian priests. But let's take a look at some of the sources we have here. The picture, by the way, is eternal fire in a Zoroastrian temple in Iran today, like a current thing. Okay, first we have a story up here in Bava Kamma, not about Zoroastrianism, but about life under the Sasanians as opposed to life under the Parthians. And we have a story with Rav and Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana gets very angry at somebody who is disrespectful to Rav, and he actually gets up and he kills him, kills this other guy. And then Rav says to him, "Uh-oh, you're in trouble. You better get out of here." He says, "Kahana, until now there were Persian rulers who were not particular about bloodshed, but now there are Greeks who are particular about bloodshed, and they will say murder, murder. Therefore, get up and ascend to Eretz Yisrael." And Rav Kahana actually does flee to Eretz Yisrael. And what's going on here? We know, right? Look back at our timeline for a second. Rav is around at the time that the Sasanians conquer the Parthians. Okay. Who are the Persians here? Who are the Greeks? It doesn't really make sense in the context of what we hear about Persians and Greeks in other places, but in the context of this story, it makes sense that the Persians are the Parthians. The Parthians are the guys who were not so particular about bloodshed. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that they let people go around murdering. What it means is that every community had its own autonomous courts. So if you were a Jew who killed somebody, the Beit Din would deal with you. And that's what the Parthians would do. But the Greeks, i.e. the Sasanians, they have centralized courts. They're going to haul you up in front of their court, and who knows what's going to happen to you then. And they're not going to care about any extenuating circumstances, so you better get out and go to Eretz Yisrael. That's what Rav says to Rav Kahana. Okay. Now the other sources we have here are all about these guys called the Chabarim. Okay. As I noted before, fire. Fire is a very big deal. Fire is a purifying. It needs to burn all the time. And it seems that the Zoroastrian priests were jealous of fires of other people. And that's where we get these really fascinating sources about the Zoroastrians and the Jews and fire, because we use fire a lot too. Okay, so take a look at this first source in Gittin. In the meantime, they were sitting, in came a certain Chabara, right? Translated here as a Persian priest, and took the lamp from before them. Right? It doesn't really make any sense unless you understand that these guys are obsessed with fire and that they should have all the fire. Rava said, "Merciful one, let us live either in your shadow or in the shadow of the descendants of Esav," who are the descendants of Esav, Rome. What, says the Gemara, right? And we actually had this last time. Is this to say that the Romans are preferable to the Persians, right? And then we have the source that we mentioned last time. The Holy One, blessed be He, knows with regard to the Jewish people, they are unable to accept and live under Roman decrees, and therefore He arose and exiled them to Babylonia. Life is better in Babylonia than it is under the Romans. Ah, this is not difficult, right? Classic Gemara answer. This was before the Persians reached Babylonia. Here, the Persians seem to mean the Sasanians. This is after the Persians reached Babylonia. not 100% clear, but it seems that something has happened, has changed, and has made life more difficult for the Jews. Okay, again, about fire. What is the ruling with regard to moving a Hanukkah candle from before the Chabare on Shabbos, right? Chabare come along, you have Hanukkah candles, you're not allowed to put them out. It's also Shabbos, Muktzah, but it might also be something very dangerous. They don't want you to have fire. So we have a discussion in the Gemara about what to do on Shabbos and Hanukkah and these guys. And the other thing we know about them, they would do certain other things. One of them was expose their dead to vultures. They believed that this was a way to purify the dead. Obviously, this is something that is anathema to Jews, but this is what the Zoroastrians would do. Okay? They also were very careful about nida, okay? About menstruation and separation and menstrual blood. And we actually, Dr. Secunda brings some interesting sources comparing, what the Jews felt about how the Zoroastrians observed ritual purity. So with that in mind, take a look at this source. When they said to Rabbi Yochanan, the Chabarim have come to Babylonia, he shuddered and fell. He was so distressed. Right? Rabbi Yochanan in Eretz Yisrael, but he knows what's going on. They were able to issue decrees against the Jewish people with regard to three matters due to three transgressions on the part of the Jewish people. Now, obviously, the Jewish eyeglasses say, oh, why did these things happen? Not because of their religion. We don't care about their religion. It happened because we sinned. But we can look at it in a historical way and say it's also connected to their religion. They decreed against meat. And I don't know. I did not find anything that connects us to the Zoroastrian beliefs, but certainly it could. I don't know enough. Due to the failure of the Jewish people to give the priests their gifts, they decreed against the bathhouses due to their neglect of ritual immersion, meaning they have a whole story of purity laws, and they don't like our purity laws. Third, they exhumed the dead from their graves because the Jews rejoice on the holidays of the Gentiles, meaning the Chabare exposed the dead, and this is something that could affect the Jews as well. So we've got halachot and ideas that come as a reaction to what's going on with Zoroastrianism. Okay, we're kind of come to Nahardah in a minute. But one of the things we often see in the Gemara, and not only in the Gemara, but even in the Torah, in the Tanakh, is a competition between the people of Eretz Yisrael and the people of Babylonia. Who's better, right? Who are better? So we have two communities. The first time we hear about two communities, a diaspora community and an Eretz Yisrael community, happens with this exile of the Charash v'Hamasger, this earliest exile in the time of Jehoiachin in the First Temple. And we have two communities. We have a community in Babel led by Yechezkel and a community in Eretz Israel led by Yirmiyahu. And they're in competition with each other. And the Nevi'im talk about this. And later, when the Jews come back in Shivat Zion, the people who had stayed behind in Eretz Israel have conflict with the people who come back. That's not what this class is about, but it just tells you that this conflict between the land of Israel and Babylonia has been going on for a very long time, right? So I just brought you here the source that talks about the Charash v'Hamasger, right? He exiled all of Jerusalem, all the commanders, all the warriors, 10,000 exiles, all the artisans and the smiths, only the poorest people in the land were left. Okay, but once we get into the Gemara, we're hearing about, all these, I would call them, insults. This is back and forth. Rabbi Zera comes from Babylonia, moves to Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't like Babylonia. He's one of those people who's such an assimilated immigrant. Assimilated meaning he becomes part of the new community that he makes fun of his old community. So he says these foolish Babylonians, they eat bread with bread, right? He's making fun of the Babylonian food customs. And all over the Gemara, it talks about, oh, their food is better. Oh, our food is better, right? It seems so petty, but this is one of the ways that people talk about, other communities. But then we have on the other side, right? Rabbi Elazar says Ezra did not ascend from Babylonia until he made it like fine flour, and then he ascended. Meaning, Ezra made sure to take with him to Eretz Yisrael the people who had the worst yichus, right? Who did not have good family backgrounds. He took those people to the land of Israel, and the people who were left behind in Babylonia, They are the fine flower. They are the solet. They're the people whose family lineage is the best. Right? That's a pretty big insult. Right? That the people in Babylonia, their lineage is good. The people in Israel, not so much. Now, again, in Babylonia, there were differences. Some cities, they said, had good lineage. Some cities had different. It's a lot of back and forth, a lot of jibes. And probably my favorite source is this one here in the Gemara and Shabbos, where you have a group of rabbis sitting around and they're dissing Babylonia and they're saying, oh, Babylonia, they got nothing. They're so poor. Their holidays are terrible. Their chickens are skinny, right? And then Rabbi Yochanan, who had been dozing off, he wakes up and he says, what are you talking about? Rabbi Yochanan, Eretz Yisrael, lives in Tveria. He says, Babylonia, things are so much better for them. So I didn't bring you the whole source. If you want to look it up, Shabbos 145b, it's a great source, but I just brought you a little bit. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba said, what reason are the festivals in Babylonia more joyous than those in Eretz Yisrael? Rabbi Yassi said, because in Babylonia, they are poor, meaning their life is miserable all the time, right? So there, when they have chagim, when they are able to like splurge a little and have a nice meal, then they're so happy, even happier than Eretz Yisrael, right? Just to give you a contemporary example, right? Today, if we are lucky enough to live in Eretz Yisrael, we do Birkat Kohanim every day, right? In the galut, in the sad, sad galut, you are Birkat Kohanim 3 times a year, right? So that contrast. And they go on, they say, why are the chickens in Babylonia so skinny? Why the rabbis in Babylonia have certain clothes, right? And then Rabbi Yochanan wakes up and he says, what are you talking about? Why are the festivals in Babylonia more joyous? Because they weren't cursed. Everything in the land of Israel is cursed. And in Babylonia, everything's good. And the chickens never went into exile. And the rabbis are greater, right? And he goes on, right? And in terms of the festivals, Rabbi Yitzchak says there's not a single festival on which troops did not come to Tzipori, meaning what's going on? Romans coming and collecting taxes all the time. They come into the major cities, into Tzipori. They're coming, they're taking the food, they're taking the money, they're taking everything. Okay? So you have a definite contrast between the life in Babylonia, the life in Israel, but each group might see it differently. Okay? And then you have also some resentment, which again echoes to today. What's the matter with you, Babylonians? You have such a good life there. You have so much money. Why couldn't you have come to Eretz Yisrael and made things better? Right? Make Aliyah en masse and things will be so much better. Reish Lakish said to him, my God, I hate you, Babylonians. As it is written, if she is a wall, we will build a silver turret upon her. Had you rendered yourselves like a wall and all ascended to Eretz Yisrael in the days of Ezra, you would have been likened to silver, which rot does not infest. Now that you ascended like doors, meaning just a few of you are likened to cedar, which rot infests, right? By the way, we have an inverse of this. Rabbi Yehuda in Babylonia says, no, you can't all come up at once. This is decree. You can't do Aliyah kichoma. You can't come as a wall. So there's a lot of back and forth here. And of course, we could come up with so many modern parallels that we are not going to do. But the conflict goes back and forth. Taxes are harder in Eretz Yisrael. Religious persecution might be harder in Eretz Yisrael, harder to make a living. But Eretz Yisrael is so important, right? And Babylonians say, well, your life is so hard that our yeshivot are thriving so much more. So a lot of back and forth. We cannot continue because we won't finish even half of what I want to do here. Okay, moving right along. So to take a look at our first yeshivot, okay? Nehardah is the father of all of the yeshivot, as we said. In fact, some people translate Nahardah as they take it into two words, Nahar De'ah, the river of wisdom, the river of knowledge. This is clearly not the original meaning of it, but it's a beautiful idea. And the tradition about Nahardah is that this is where the first exiles come. Rav Shvira Gaon, writing many years later, in his Egeret Rav Shriro, writing the history of the Tanaim and the Amoraim and the Geonim, he says that the exiles from Eretz Yisrael brought stones from the foundation of the Beit HaMikdash, from the Beit HaMikdash, not from the foundation, and they used it to create the foundations of a synagogue called Shef V'Yativ. Okay, this is the first source here. The father of Shmuel, Avuha de Shmuel, and Levi, not the father of Shmuel and Levi, but the father of Shmuel, comma, and Levi, were once sitting in the synagogue of Shef V'Yativ in Nahar Da'ash. Shef V'Yativ means came and sat. Right, they came from the land of Israel and they sat. They settled in Nahar Da, and this is what Rav Shira Gaon says. This is the synagogue that was created with stones from the Beit HaMikdash. The divine presence came, and they heard a loud sound, so they arose and left. Meaning that this is a Gemara Megillah that talks about where does the Shekhinah visit, and this is one of the places that the Shekhinah visits. So it's a very important old community. The yeshiva is founded there. Shmuel becomes the most important teacher in this yeshiva. He is a Nahar Da patriot, right? Very famous statement by Shmuel. The paths of the sky are as clear to me as the paths of my city of Nahar Da. Shmuel was an astronomer and he knew the stars. And he says, I know it as well as my city of Nahar Da. It becomes a very important Rosh yeshiva. Later, Rav Nachman becomes a Rosh yeshiva in Nahar Da, but the city is destroyed. Right? City is destroyed. Newer yeshivot are created, but many generations later, right? Gemara in Bava Kamma brings a source and says, Amrei Nehardai. The sages of Nahar Da say Nahar Da has been destroyed for decades, perhaps centuries, but the name lives on. Right? You talk about Panovich, you talk about Vilna, you talk about the places, Lakewood, great yeshivot. Nahar Da is one of those great yeshivot. Rav has a different story. Okay, Rav goes to the land of Israel, studies in the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. That experience is so significant that Rav is one of the only Amoraim who is called a Tana. He's not called an Amora, even though chronologically he's an Amora, but he has the status of a Tana, Rav Tana Upali. Because he sat and he studied from Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. So you have the source in the Gemara in Chulin here on the second column. I remember when I sat 17 rows behind Rav, who sat before Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and fiery sparks emerged from the mouth of Rav to the mouth of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and from the mouth of Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi to the mouth of Rav, and I did not know what they said, right? So obviously, a nice metaphor, but brilliant discourse between Rabbi and Rav. In 219, Rav returns to Babylonia. Where does he go? He goes to Nahar Da. That's the place to go. But Shmuel and another rabbi named Karna are seeing him coming, and there's some bad blood. There's some competition. There's a long, complicated story here. The Gemara in Shabbos 108, Rav Benny Lau explains it very nicely. We're not going to go into it, but basically, Shmuel and Karna don't make life easy for Rav. Shmuel and Karna were sitting on the bank of the Manka River. They saw that the water was rising. It was murky. Shmuel said to Karna, "A great man is coming from the west, meaning from Israel, and his intestines are aching, and the water is rising to greet him. Go sniff out his container," meaning go check him out. Go find out what his story is. Rav doesn't do so well in Nahar Da for various reasons, and he decides to strike out on his own, and he goes south to make his own yeshiva in Sura. Let's just go back for a moment, right? Nahar Da up here. He goes down to Sura and he decides to create his own yeshiva in kind of this virgin territory. And he comes to this place, which is basically a place of ignoramuses. And he manages to create a great yeshiva there. So we have this story here in the Gemara in Chulin. We have a few other stories. Rav found an unguarded valley and fenced it in, meaning this is a metaphor, right? A geder. We always have gederot in the Torah. We put up a fence so that we keep our mitzvot. What happens? Rav arrived in Tatlefush, right, in this place in the south. He heard a certain woman saying to another, "How much milk does it require to cook a quarter weight of meat?" Oh boy, right? Can't get much worse than bishul basar v'chalav. Rav said, "Evidently, these people are not learned enough to know that meat cooked in milk is prohibited." Rav tarried in that place and prohibited even udders to them, right? There's an opinion that says you can have a cow's udder, and that's sort of like meat and milk. He says, we're not messing around with these people. They don't know enough to be allowed subtleties. We're going to make a lot of rules that they will have to keep. This is not Sura, but it's near Sura. And Sura and Rav goes and he builds up Sura till it becomes a great yeshiva, right? And here you have this last source here, right? The Pasuk in Yechezkel, I have been to them a little sanctuary, a mikdash ma'at. Rav Yitzchak says this is referring to the synagogues and study halls in Babylonia. Rabbi Elazar said, this is referring to the house of our master, meaning Rav in Babylonia. Rav is the Mikdash Ma'at. He creates this Mikdash Ma'at in Sura. Okay, so let's just take a quick look at what we've been doing over the past 2.5 classes, right? Amoraim in Eretz Yisrael, Amoraim in Babylonia. This is obviously not everybody, but just some of the major centers that we talked about. Again, this is not Tanaim, this is Amoraim. So we have Lud, we have Caesarea, right? We've talked about Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Hoshaya. We have Haifa and Akko, fewer teachers, but they also are important. And of course, Tzipori and Tveria, which are really the height, the most important in Tveria. We have Rabbi Yochanan, we have Reish Lakish, Rabbi Ami, Rabbi Asi, right? All of these great rabbis. In Babylonia, we have our various important sites. We have Nahar Da with Shmuel and Rav Nachman. We have Sura with Rav and the teachers that come off after him. We have Pumbedita with Rav Yehuda. Right, very, very important teacher, Rabbi Zeira, who eventually leaves. Okay, we have Mochoza with Rabbi Yosef, and with Rava. Okay, and we have Mata Mechasia. Okay, with we have Mata Mechasia. We don't have anybody. Oh, not Mata Mechasia. Excuse me. Oh yeah, we don't. They didn't put anybody in here. I don't know why. Okay, or maybe. It's down here, Mata Mahasya. Yes. No arrow, but this is where it is. Okay, and Kafri. So we get all of our great leadership, and there are more names. We're not going to go into everybody. Okay, but we're going to move along and try to finish up with a few other places that are not in Babylonia. Okay, so first we're going to talk about a place that has a few different names. Okay, Tadmor or Tamar, which is really the same name. And Palmyra, which, as you can see in Palmyra, is the word palm, right? Like a palm tree. So a Tamar, a Palmyra, it's the same thing. Where are we? Okay, this is on the map here. I highlighted it. This is in essentially northern Syria. Okay. And basically it's on this route. Remember we said the route that takes you through the Fertile Crescent so that you can go into the land between the rivers. Very important. So this is on a trade route. We hear about this place already in Sefer Malachim and in Sefer Divrei HaYamim about King Solomon building himself a town. Okay. It's called Tadmor. It's also called Tamar in Malachim Aleph. It seems it's the same place. He built Tadmor in the desert. This is the first source here. And all the garrison towns that he built in Hamat. This gives us a hint where this is, right? Hamat is up here, not far from Aram. And it's a desert oasis. It's on this caravan route. So it's a very important place economically. It's also very important politically because it's essentially between the Romans and the Parthians. And therefore they can dictate their own terms because everybody wants them. And in fact, in the 3rd century, you actually have a ruler who's a queen. Her name is Zenobia. She rebels against Rome. She conquers Egypt. She's really great while she lasts, and then she's exiled and the city is destroyed. Okay. But we hear about these people from Palmyra, from Tadmor. They speak Greek, they speak Aramaic, but they also have their own language called Palmyrene, and this is an inscription on the bottom in that language. Okay. And Chazal mentioned both non-Jews and Jews from these places. Okay. So take a look in the Gemara in Yevamot. We hear about the non-Jews who it seems were very, very cruel. When the Gentiles entered the sanctuary during the conquest of Jerusalem, they all turned to plunder the silver and gold, but the warriors of Tadmor, it's all the same place, turned to the daughters of Jerusalem, right? They were not interested in the silver and gold. They just wanted to attack and to rape. So that's the assessment of the goyim. Okay. We have kind of a more neutral statement, the very famous story about Hillel, who gets bugged by the guy, Erev Shabbos, right? The guy who tries to make him lose his patience, and he comes to him, and every time Shmuel is like taking a shower and he knocks on the door and he asks him another, what we would call today, klutz kashas. So one of his questions is, why are the eyes of the residents of Tadmor bleary, right? Trutot, why do they have these like eyes that look like they're, all red? Hillel said to him, my son, you have asked a significant question. The reason is because they live among the sands, right? They live in the sand. The sand irritates their eyes. That's the answer. Okay. We also have sources about Jews in Tadmor. Okay. So here we have a source in the Yerushalmi. Zeir ben Chinana was captured at Safsufa. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Shmuel went to negotiate for him. So here we've got Jews. Right, who are living in Tadmor. They're captured, right? Pidyon Shvuyim, very important topic, as we know today. And these rabbis go, and who's in charge is Queen Zenobia. She doesn't have a lot of sympathy. She says, your creator usually does wonders for you. Put him under pressure. What are you bothering me? Go pray. Pray and see what God can do for you. Right? Finally, in the necropolis in Beit Sha'arim, right, in the north of Israel, we have the town that Rebbe lived in, Beit Sha'arim. And when he died, he was buried there. And Jews from all over the diaspora wanted to be buried next to Rebbe. We have these amazing sarcophagi and inscriptions of Jews from all different places. And we have a few from Tadmor, right? We have one that says the sons of Leontios, the banker from Palmyra. And we have another one that says Germanus ben Yitzchak, the Tadmorite. And we actually have inscriptions that are written in this Palmyrian script, it's Palmyrian language. Finally, Mishnah and Nazir, here's another Jew, a Jewish woman. And we have a couple of Jewish women from abroad. We're going to see another one in a minute, who take on the vows of being a Nazir. Okay, a Nazir can be a man, can be a woman, and you don't have to live in Eretz Israel. Eventually, you have to come to Israel to the Beit HaMikdash to give your sacrifices to end your period of Nazirut. But we hear about two famous women who are not from the land of Israel who become Nazirot. And here we have this one named Miriam, Miriam of Tarmod. Unfortunately, we don't know anything else about her except that she became a Nazir. So, kind of cool, but we don't have any other information. Maybe someone will write a fictional novel about her. Okay. The other place that is in this area of kind of northern Syria, a little bit more famous because of the woman who comes from there, and that's a place called Adiabene. Okay. Adiabene, I think we had it on one of our maps back here. Yes. Okay. Here's Adiabene, more or less the same area, right? Also on this trade route. Okay. Adiabene had a royal family, a king named Izatis, a queen named Helena, and then she had sons, Munbaz, and then their son was also named Izatis. And a Jewish trader came through Adiabene. Probably a lot of Jewish traders came through Adiabene. But this one, according to Josephus, right, a Jewish historian of Second Temple, got to know the queen, Queen Helene, and he talked to her about Judaism. And she was so taken by this that she converted to Judaism. She converted, her sons converted, and we hear about her in all sorts of places. She appears in Josephus. She appears in Chazal. She's kind of this very fascinating figure who's very wealthy, who comes to the land of Israel, and she's kind of like a fairy godmother. She does all of these things. She feeds the poor of Jerusalem during a famine. She gives donations to the Beit HaMikdash, right? So let's just take a look at a couple of sources about her, okay? This is from Josephus. About this time, it was that Helena, queen of Adiabene, and her son Izates changed their course of life and embraced the Jewish customs. But as to Helena, the king's mother, when she saw that the affairs of Izates' kingdom were at peace, and her son was a happy man and admired among all men and even among foreigners, by the means of God's providence over him, she had a mind to go to the city Jerusalem in order to worship at the temple of God, which was so very famous among all men, and offer her thanks offerings. So she desired her son to give her leave to go thither. So she comes to Jerusalem. Now that's what Josephus says. According to Chazal, for sure she's in Jerusalem. Okay. First of all, we hear in Sukkah about her sukkah. She had this huge, tall sukkah. There was an incident involving Queen Helene in Lud. where her sukkah was more than 20 cubits high, right? There's a discussion. Are you allowed to have a sukkah that's so high? And here the proof is that she made the sukkah, and the chachamim would come, and they didn't say anything to her. So, and the Gemara questions that proof, but that's not what's important for us. Okay. She donated things to the Beit HaMikdash. Kidmon Baz would make the handles of all the Yom Kippur vessels of gold, right? That's one of her sons. Queen Helene, his mother, fashioned a gold chandelier above the entrance of the sanctuary. She also fashioned a golden tavla on which the Torah portion relating to the Soto was written. Okay, so she gave all these donations to the Beit HaMikdash. And finally, here she is as a Nazir again. An incident occurred with regard to Queen Helene, whose son had gone to war, and she said, "If my son will return from war safely, I will be a Nazirite for 7 years." And her son returned, and she was a Nazirite for 7 years, and at the end of 7 years, she ascended to Eretz Yisrael. So fascinating testimony, these women who come to take on these vows of being a Nazir and come to Israel. Now, do we hear about Queen Helene outside of our sources? Yes. In the 19th century, there was an amazing, beautiful tomb that was discovered to the north of the Old City, okay, on what's called Derech Shechem. Eventually, it came to belong to the French government. It's a whole complicated story. This tomb first got the name the Tomb of the Kings because it was so majestic and big and beautiful that the assumption was, oh, it must have been built for David and Solomon. But as it was explored and as we started to learn more about tombs and how they were created, it became clear that this was not a first temple period tomb, but a second temple period tomb. And while they were excavating it, they found this very beautiful sarcophagus, okay? Very simple, but very expensively made. If you want to see it, you have to go to the Louvre. Was taken by the French, okay? And on it, in Palmyrian letters, remember they're very close to Palmyra, as well as in Aramaic, it says, you could even see actually very faintly, sorry, it's not the best picture, but you can see the Aramaic letters. It says Tzadan Malkita. It says the same thing in Palmyrian. Now, what does that mean? It could mean our mistress, the queen, or it could mean Tzadan, the queen. It could be that Queen Helene's, that Helene was her Greek name, and her Palmyrian name was Tzadan. We don't know. But in any case, it's the sarcophagus of a queen. And so we assume that this tomb is actually Queen Helene's tomb, which is a very neat thing to have discovered. A few years ago, when they were uncovering the amazing mansion in the Givati parking lot outside of Ir David, there was a suggestion that maybe one of these mansions was Queen Helene's mansion, because Josephus talks about how she built her home in the lower city. We don't know. We don't have proof, but it's possible. Okay, we've got three more places. Are we going to get to them? Maybe. Okay, Rome. You cannot read the Gemara without coming across Rome. Rome as a real place, Rome in the rabbinic imagination. Rome looms very, very large. Obviously, because the Romans are the ones who destroyed the temple, so they are kind of this iconic nation, this iconic in a terrible way. They are associated with Esav. Once Rome becomes Christian, Esav becomes Christian as well, right? Esav is Rome, the Roman Empire. It's the Christian Empire. So they are very, very important, but they're also very important in reality. There's a Jewish community in Rome. There are many rabbis who visit Rome. Prisoners are redeemed in Rome. The monuments of Rome, some of them are built with Jewish money. Okay, so it's in some ways it's kind of an imaginary place, like a place that you connect all sorts of bad things to, but it's also a very real place. We know there's a Jewish community in Rome already in Hasmonean times. Judah Maccabee goes to Rome and visits the Jewish community. Jewish community grows a lot after the destruction of the Second Temple because many Jews are taken captive and brought to Rome, and they're ransomed by the Jewish community. And so the Jewish community grows. You have traders who are living on the right bank of the Tiber River. The city of Rome burns down in a famous fire. in the late first century of the Common Era, and it's rebuilt, and a lot of the rebuilding happens with Jewish money. Okay, so for example, the Colosseum, which you see in the picture here, was built with money that was taken from the temple. The Via Sacra, right, the sacred way, is dominated by the Arch of Titus, which of course shows the Roman soldiers carrying away the spoils from the temple. Vespasian, the general who is one of the conquerors of Jerusalem, built what's called the Temple of Peace to showcase the treasures of the temple. If you look at the last source here, Gemara and Shabbos, Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi, yes, he says, he's talking about the tzitz, the Kohen Gadol's headpiece. I saw it in the city of Rome, right? He actually saw it. And sacred to God was written on one line. If you want to listen to a very interesting podcast, Stephen Fine, who wrote a whole book about the menorah, talks about how the menorah is clearly not in the Vatican. But at some point, it was displayed in the Temple of Peace. Right. What happened to it afterwards? That's a very interesting question. But it is taken, it's taken to Rome. The Jews, there's a Jewish community, as we said, in Rome. There's even some very important people. If you look at the first source here, the Gemara in Pesachim, Rabbi Yossi said, Todos or Theodosius of Rome instituted the custom for the Roman Jews to eat a gdi mikulas, a roasted goat, whole on the evening of Passover, which we know you don't do, right? You're not supposed to do that. It's like the Korban Pesach. We don't want to do that. The rabbi sent a message to him. If you were not, we would have decreed ostracism upon you. We would have put you in Cheirem. As it appears, if you are feeding Israel consecrated food outside, it looks like you're making korbanot when you're not in the Beit HaMikdash. So they have their own customs. He's a very significant person. The rabbis don't want to put him in Cheirem. Hey, the picture that you have here on the right is pictures from the Jewish catacombs in Rome, which obviously have Greek writing, but they have Jewish symbols. They have menorah, lulav, etrog. Right? It's a very proud Jewish community. The source here in the middle, a very famous source in the Gemara and Makkot about the rabbis in Rome, right? Hearing the sounds of the multitudes, right? Hearing the crowds shouting in the Colosseum, and everybody starts crying. Right? The second half of this Gemara is more famous, where they're walking towards Har HaBayit, and they see the fox coming out of Har HaBayit. But we also have this part where they hear the shouting from the multitudes of Rome, and Rabbi Akiva is laughing, and the rabbis are crying, and Rabbi Akiva, the rabbis say, why are you weeping? These Gentiles who bow to false gods and burn incense to idols dwell securely, and for us, our temple is burnt by fire. Shall we not weep? Rabbi Akiva says, I'm laughing. For those who violate his will, it is so. For those who perform his will, all the more so will they be rewarded. So Rome and the rabbis is a very long and complicated story. The rabbis basically say Rome and Jerusalem, or as they put it, Caesarea and Jerusalem, they can't both thrive. It's not possible. If one is doing well, the other is doing badly. These are two antithetical value systems. Okay, we'll finish up this one, and the next one we'll save for next time. Alexandria and Egypt, also port city, major trade, lots of Jews, many, a very strong Jewish community. We have this great passage in the Gemara and Sukkah, talking about the synagogue, the Dioflostone of Alexandria, this huge synagogue in Alexandria, which obviously the numbers here are inflated. You had twice the number of those that left Egypt. It is amazing, 71 chairs, but two great details, right? There's so many people here. Take a look about the middle here. The sexton of the synagogue would stand on a platform with scarves in his hand, or flags, really, is a better phrase. When the prayer leader reached to answer Amen, the sexton waved the scarf, and all the people would answer Amen. There's no microphones. It's a huge place. How can you possibly hear anything, right? Don't get into the halachic question of, are you allowed to answer Amen if you didn't hear the bracha? But it just gives you a sense of the hugeness of this place, right? That's one great detail. The other great detail is the members of the craft, various crafts would sit separately. The goldsmiths would sit by themselves, the silversmiths, the blacksmiths, etc. And when a poor stranger entered, he would recognize people who plied his craft, and he would turn to join them, and then he would secure his livelihood, right? You had these guilds, these Landsmannschaften, communities where people would join the people who are like them, and that's how they would get a job. And the Jews of Alexandria at one point Two out of five quarters of the city had a Jewish majority. Okay? They are a very powerful, very important community. In the Great Library of Alexandria, you have the Targum Shebeim, the translation into Greek that the Jews make of the Torah. Tragically, the city is, the Jewish community, the synagogue is destroyed in the second century in the Trajan Revolt. But one last story. We have a guy named Nicanor. Right? He's mentioned in a few places in the Gemara. For the beautiful gates that he donates to the Beit HaMikdash,
Oh,
he builds these
came
beautiful copper gates.
on.
He brings them on a ship to Eretz Yisrael.
Goodness.
There's a terrible storm. One of the gates has to be thrown overboard. And he's very, very distressed. And then when they get into the port, they find the gate. This is a great story. And in about 120 years ago, there was a burial cave that was discovered on Har HaTzofim in Jerusalem with ancient ossuaries in them, right? Burial bone boxes. And one of them said on it in Greek, Nicanor who made the gates.
Oh.
And in Aramaic, Nicanor Alexa, Nicanor from Alexandria. So Nicanor, like Queen Helene, was a real person. And the story with his gates. See
Mark.
what happened. Okay, we'll do our last two places next time. Meanwhile, I am going to stop sharing. I'm going to take a look at the comments and if anybody else
That we can
has
still.
comments. Let's take a look. Whoever's talking, if you're not talking, mute
Out across the street
yourself, please.
ways.
Thank you.
But sure, my cards.
Okay. Not unlike the back and forth between America and Israel, yes, but they didn't have, LL planes, so a
Yes,
lot harder.
which really has a,
Things.
it's
Okay.
rosy.
People do drown in the Dead Sea, that's true, but we're not talking about that. Who destroyed Narda? It's part of the battles that are going on with the Sasanians, and Narda was destroyed. I have to say I didn't look deeply into the destruction. I would have to look it up to tell you a better answer. Okay. Right, Manichaeism is even more of the dichotomy. Yeah, the Sasanians are not Greeks, but the Gemara sometimes mixes up ideas of who's Greek, who's Persian, what are the names? Are the names the same names that we use? Don't be so hung up on it. You have to look more at the context and who is speaking and the time period, and it makes more sense. But also Greek, realize when we say Greek, the Parthians are also considered Greek. They're not Greek, but they're Hellenized, right? They take on a lot of Greek customs, Greek language, Greek ideas. So maybe that's part of the idea of what we're talking about. Perhaps those who returned to Israel were those who weren't doing well in Babel. That's very possible. Yes, right? That's a whole Shibat Zion story is very interesting. Okay, the journey, right? So we didn't talk so much about this. Yeah, they did not have a nice, kosher burgers bar on the way, but we do know that they would go in what's called a shayara, in a caravan, right? You would wait for a cat. You didn't travel by yourselves. Very dangerous. You had to go when there was a caravan, a group traveling together. They're traveling on animals. It's clearly not something that is so safe necessarily. They're traveling a well-traveled path with other people along the way. But yeah, it's daunting, but people definitely, definitely did it. And for sure, families did too, because they would come on Aliyah LaRegel. How often? Probably not so often, but people definitely did do it. Food, I think that, they would bring food with them, and they were not into, finding a hechsher like we are. They would buy grain, they would buy fruit, they would buy all different kinds of things. Palmyrene is in a separate language, okay, but the writing is different. But thank you. That's very interesting about the Aramaic. Stephen Fine, like, what a fine day. Fine. Okay. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? So silent. Okay. Thank you, everybody. And have
Thank
a
you,
Shabbat
Julie.
Shalom. And we should
Hi.
have Besorot Tovot. And see you guys next week, Be'ezrat Hashem. Thanks.
Yes, good.
Thank you.
Thank you
Thank you,
very much,
Shirley.
Julie. Please.
Thank you, Shirley. Thank you
Bye
so much.
bye. Thank you.
Thank you, Shirley.
Oh God, thank you.